Thank you, John. Hi, everybody. My name is Tom. I'm an alcoholic. And a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to write down the time I started, but don't pay any attention to that. I mean, that's just this. In case we get in an argument later on about 11:30 tonight about how long I talk, I mean, I will have some documentary evidence as to when I started. I want to thank whoever it was that was responsible for asking me to come here. I assume it was a committee. It's always a committee. I want to thank Ann for inviting me and for directing my trip, which she did. I said this before, I'll say it again. Ann is a skilled craftsman in the art of the written word. And her letters are just unbelievable communication. As I said last night, she writes letters where the words jump out at you and say, "Hey, you, listen up, I'm talking to you." And you pay attention. And I come from an extended family of letter writers, and it's a lost art. It's dying out. Another generation, nobody will know how to write letters. I mean, everything can be faxes, for Christ's sake. And Ann can put something in her letters that you can't get in a fax, I'll tell you that for sure. Then I want to thank Bill for picking me up at Pensacola and driving me over here. That's one place Ann goofed. She said a committee was going to meet me. I get off the plane looking for a committee. There's one lone, pitiful fellow holding up a piece of scratch pad with Tom O on it. For a minute, I decided to walk right on by and make it like I hit. That was Bill. I want to thank Bill. I'm glad you were there, man. I might still be in Pensacola if you hadn't been there. And then I want to thank John. John said some nice things about me, and I deserve all of them, but I profited tremendously from these days with John. He's a unique fellow. I'm not going to go into any effort to tell you what his uniqueness consists of, but I had a guy introduce me one time, and the fellow really didn't know me. And I was wondering what he was going to say, and what he said was, "I don't really know this guy, but I think he would help a drunk." And I never have forgotten that, because you can't make much of a better introduction of an AA member than that. That's what I think about John. He's got qualifications galore, but I think he would help a drunk. And then I want to thank, you know, this has been a watershed experience for me, because there are so many of my old There are so many of my dear friends of long standing here. People that I shared the earlier days with, and it's been a delight, you know, to see them and be with them again. And then I want to thank all of you 6,500 people. That's when I get home. For being here, really it's only about 400 miles from the town I live in. But even at that, I'd hate to come down here and not have anybody show up. So I owe each one of you a deep gratitude, debt of gratitude for being here. I have no idea what I'm going to say. I want to say this before I get started. No one speaks for AA, least of all me. I just put that in there as a disclaimer so that I can say whatever I want to say and then say that it's my... Now, don't come up and say that it's just my opinion, because I don't have opinions. I've got convictions. They may be wrong, but they're my convictions. But I don't speak for AA. So, I really am glad to be here. I'm taking some medicine that makes my mouth dry. And the lady that spoke last night, I could identify with everything she said. And, you know, she said with her glass of water that she couldn't hold it up steadily for the first few minutes. And that's why I got the can. I mean, I can't handle those, you know, short strength. Now, she was really, I was beginning to identify with her, and that's practically the first thing she says. And then if you're still here, I want to find out what it was that you said that equaled... Oh, shit. Was it, I'm sorry that you think that's what I meant? Or, anyway, I've got to get that before I go home. Because there's just a jillion people back home that I want to say, oh, shit, to them. And as soon as I get back home, I'm going to get a public forum and establish that that's what I mean by the phrase that you used. And then look out. I had a talk all day, and Francine went and screwed the whole thing up. I mean, she took all the stuff that I wanted to say and said it. I had a whole 15 minutes on this thing up here, and you concisely put it in attorney terminology, which is narrow thinking. Concisely, you put it, see? That's what you people do. Everything you do is concise, including your fees. So I have no idea what I'm going to say. I read this story in a real serious magazine. Honestly, it was. It was a serious theological magazine that touches on current topics. And the story is about an Irishman that got a job in a brewery, and one day he slipped on a wet spot on the floor and fell in the vat where the final product was stored, and he drowned. And when his wife came to get his still dripping wet body, she said to the foreman, well, at least it was quick. And as he sadly shook his head, he said, no, not really. He said several times he got out to go to the bathroom. And really, you know, I have said everything I have to say when I tell you that. But of course, that doesn't mean that I'm going to stop. I'm going to do something that I, you know, every inch of me says don't do it. But I've had at least a half a dozen people ask me to tell one story. And the reason I hesitate to tell a story is I originated the story, and there's a frequent flyer up in Saskatchewan, Canada, who roamed around the United States and particularly was fond of this part of the country when Wesley Parrish was still living. And he goes around telling people that it's his story. And if you've ever heard him tell it, all you got to do is listen to me tell it, and you'll know that it's my story. It's about the three drunk rabbits. And their names were Foot and Foot Foot and Foot Foot Foot. Now, they weren't just drunk rabbits, they were alcoholic rabbits, and they were always arguing with each other. You know, Foot, Foot, Foot would go to Foot, Foot, and he'd say, Foot, steal my booze. And Foot would say, look, Foot, Foot, you and Foot, 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 going to have to straighten that out by yourself. I don't want to get involved in it. Leave me alone. And this kind of thing went on all the time. And one day, Foot died. And they gave him a good funeral, but you know how it is. You've got to get juiced up to go to a funeral. And after it was all over, they were sitting alongside a fence. You know how a drunk rabbit looked. And Foot, Foot, Foot turned to Foot, Foot, and he said, well, I guess we might as well go to Alcoholics Anonymous now that we got one foot in the grave. And there's a lot of money floating around nowadays studying alcoholism and alcoholics. And half of me applauds this, and the other half of me just hilariously laughs at it. The idea apparently is to find out what makes an alcoholic, or how does one become an alcoholic. And they're given grant money for this. And I like grant money because you don't have to really put up anything for it, you know. That's like the Serenity Prayer. I mean, the Serenity Prayer is a typical alcoholic prayer. It's a typical Serenity, I mean, a typical Mooch's prayer, for crying out loud. That's what it's saying. It's saying, God grant me. You know, like a block development grant. I ain't got anything, but give me what I'm asking for. Courage and surrender and all that kind of stuff. And that's why I'd like to get some of the grant money, because you don't have to put anything up for it. And the clicker is that I already know how one becomes an alcoholic. Now, if you're going to be an alcoholic, you have to drink. And it's just that simple. I mean, you can complicate it from now till kingdom come. And that's the one thing you have to do in order to be an alcoholic, is to drink. And really, it's not like it was in when I came into this organization. It used to be we'd slip down back alleys and give false names and put raincoats and umbrellas over our heads and all this stuff. We didn't want anybody to know we had a drinking problem. We've been sleeping on Main Street for the past week. But we didn't want anybody to know that, you know, this is one thing. I really never have seen nor known an anonymous alcoholic. We go out and do all kinds of things. At least I did. Get drunk and, you know, we don't have town drunks anymore, but that's because the culture has shifted to the suburbs. And we don't have any downtown for the poor drunks to get drunk in. But we have suburban drunks. We got condominium drunks. Super movie drunks. Parking lot drunks. Shopping mall drunks. You name it. We got them all. And you know, you could almost diagnose the difference between a drunk and an alcoholic by calling the cops. Because if it's just a plain drunk, he'll go hide. But if it's an alcoholic and he thinks the cop don't see him, he'll get around in front of him so he can't miss him. And then one day, for whatever the reason, the poor alcoholic decides he's going to stop drinking, and he comes to AA and starts to straighten his life up. And the very first thing he says is, "Shh, don't tell anybody." So that's our part of the bargain. You've been a bum all your life. You're no damn good. And now you're going to straighten your life out and learn how to live like a lady and gentleman. And our part of the deal is we ain't going to tell anybody about it. But you see, when I came in, we were ashamed of it because it wasn't accepted like that anymore. And so we used to slip into AA meetings, give false names and all this kind of stuff. And today, really, and I'm not joking about this, it's an in thing to belong to Alcoholics Anonymous in many places today. It's a kind of a chic thing. It's a social climbers want to get into Alcoholics Anonymous. They really, I'm not joking, they really and truly do. I see people coming in here and tell the damnedest lies. See, what they do is they like all the good stuff we got going in here. I mean, all the loving and the hugging and the kissing and the bumping and stuff that goes on. And they want to come in here and be part of it, but they miss out on the part about not drinking. I know people that will drink and puke and quit. You can't get anywhere that way. I mean, you've got to give it some kind of decent trial. So I think that that's one thing that it's important for me to stand up here and say, since in a sense, the minute I stand up here, I am somewhat public as far as Alcoholics Anonymous is going, and I think that I should just plain say out loud this deep, fundamental, philosophical reality that if you want to be an alcoholic, you've got to drink. So, there's another thing that we miss out on too a lot of times around alcoholics, and that is, there's a lot of people that still love all these good things we've got, and they miss out on another thing that's real important in AA, and that is, if you want to be a member, you've got to quit. There just is nothing else to say about that. I mean, if you want to be a member of alcoholics, we're the only organization in the whole world that don't have a real, honest to God member that drinks. Somebody's going to say, well, the third tradition said, I know what the third tradition said, but AA members don't drink. But I like what Francine said today. I mean, if you just want to come here drunk and don't cause too much trouble, you know, come on in. We'd be glad to have you. Come on in and undergo an apprenticeship for membership, you know. And then when you're ready, actually it says this in the book, I mean right smack in the middle of page 58, and I think we should all read this and remember it. It says, if you have decided that you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And so, you know, I don't think it makes any difference. I don't care how a person comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think it makes a bit of difference. I think it makes all the difference in the world. Why will you stay here? But that's the subject that I'll get in about an hour and a half from now. And so, we've got two problems. One is that you, in order to be an alcoholic, you have to drink. The other is that in order to be an AA member, you have to quit. And for the group that falls under the heading of if you want to be a member, you've got to quit, I think it's not entirely their fault. I don't think we tell them the whole truth when they first come here. You see, there's a requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't make it up. You see, when I got here. The requirement for membership in AA is a desire to stop drinking. And I think the real trouble is that most people don't know what a desire is. I think that people in general think that a desire is something that if you got it, it's okay. If you don't have it, it's okay. It don't make a lot of difference. That's not what a desire is. My wife taught me what a desire is. My wife died a couple of years ago after 38 years of a very happy marriage. And I know one day we had some people over in the house, and she kept saying, I married her for a cook, and she was a superb cook. But she said it to the point where I just couldn't stand it anymore, and I interrupted, and I said, you know, I never will forget the day I first saw you, and you were walking down that hospital corridor on those high heels, shaking from side to side, and I told her, I said, you know, if you think I married you for your cooking, you're nuts. And I know that things have changed since I came into AA. The whole culture has changed, and I have to accommodate myself to some of the realities of the day. When I came in, it was almost socially required that if you had sex with a woman, you should know her first name, but... I'm not a critic of modern customs. I mean, what the women did back in those days, they knew by instinct that attraction was better than promotion. And we had courting periods, and they used to lead us on and lead us on and lead us on, put a lot of ideas in our head, get us all ready for action, and then one day they draw a line and say, oh. And what they really said, if you ever stopped to think about it, was, if you've decided you want what I got, and and are ready to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Of course, it's some of these we bought. We thought we could find an easier, softer way. You see, that's a desire. A desire is a screaming, meaning itch to get the thing you desire, and you do anything in God's green earth to get it. And I'll tell you another thing about a desire. If you're going to desire something, you have to have some kind of general idea of what it is that you're going to desire in the first place. I mean, you can't just go out and sit in a field and desire. Well, I really needed the anesthetic when it came around the first time, the second time. I had had experience with it prior to this, and you know, it was kid stuff. I got drunk. What the heck does a 15-year-old know about anything, much less drinking? But I was doing it because everybody else did it, and I think that's a perfectly valid reason for young people to do anything. And for some that are not so young as far as that's concerned, but anyway, I had disastrous effects, but I wanted to, I still live in a small town, a real small town, a real dump. There's two of my friends over there that have been in meetings in my home group, and they're laughing, you see. It really is. And I wanted to get out of there and go off into the wide yonder and be a success and a hero. And so I didn't keep up. I call this kid drinking, this initial experience that I had with the anesthetic. And later on, I am a third generation, I'm the descendant of third generation, second generation Irish immigrant. I'm the third generation. And I come from a closely knit extended family. And they had goals for the people that followed them. They wanted each generation to improve itself to some extent. So they would all chip in, you see, and finance my endeavors to improve myself. And so I got to go off to college, and I was thrilled and delighted. I used to lie awake in bed at night and just, you know, project in my fantasy how great it would be when I got off to college. And when I got off there, it wasn't great at all. I was in a worse condition than I was when I was back home in Lake Providence. I began to run into people that had so many things that I didn't have, and that knew so many things that I didn't know. They had more money than I did, but it wasn't just money. It was things like music and literature and architecture, and they could talk about these things. And these were things that were real hazy as far as I was concerned then. And I felt absolutely out of place. I just did not belong with that group of people. And I was desperate and depressed because I had put so much expectation into what it was going to be. And I just, you know, I was a nerd. That word hadn't been coined yet, but I just was that far ahead of my time. And I remember, for example, one night, four couples of us went out for a steak dinner. You could get a steak dinner, a good one, man, for 35 cents back in those days. And we were seated at a... couldn't you? Huh? We were seated around a round table, and the waitress came around and asked everybody what kind of dressing they wanted on this salad. And when she got to me, I said, crab. And see, you're just like they were. They laughed at me. And it hurt my feelings. I didn't know there was any other kind of dressing besides craft, to tell you the truth. But I tell you what I did right then and there. I had to, right that instant, I began to develop a lifestyle which continued until long after I had come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was this. That whenever I said anything, I had to observe you closely to see how you understood it so I could decide how I meant it. And if you laughed, I was a comedian, and if you looked puzzled, I was a philosopher. And I began to go through life with this approach toward it. And I dealt successfully with that very approach. And as I say, it lasted until long after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I discovered that I was afraid of people. That was my big problem. I was afraid of people. Now, you could have put me in a room with 25 chairs, and it didn't bother me at all. Chairs and I got along fine together, but not people. I was terrified of people. I would stammer and shake and make nonsense sounds, you know, like, and stuff like that. And I just didn't fit in, that's all. And I could tell, you know, if I stood up before a group of people like you, say, only one or two thoughts would come into my mind. Do you threaten me or can I use you? And this was pain, this was agony, and maybe you could have seen it on my face, maybe you couldn't, I don't know. But I lived like this all the time. And quite by accident, I wished I hadn't been that way. But I heard a guy say one time, he was a physician, he was a nose and throat specialist, and he said something that I never will forget, because I had the same feeling. He said that he thought maybe God made people on an assembly line belt. And that when he got right in front of God, somebody in the back of the room said, "Hey, God," and he turned around, and the belt went by. And he didn't get a part that he was supposed to get. And that's just about how I felt, you know. I was lacking something, and I began to drink, and something had changed in me because I didn't have the, you know, back in the initial contact with alcohol, I did a lot of throwing up. I used to say puking because I think puking is a more sanitary word than throwing up. I don't know, throwing up has, you know, it gives me a picture of stuff splattering out and all the rest. Really, if you stop to think about it, and I've done a lot of, given a lot of thought, I've meditated on this thing. Puking is clean and direct. The differences, depending on what you've been drinking, if you've been drinking whiskey, puking has a type fan effect, and... But if you've been drinking wine, for God's sake, you could take scissors and cut it between the time it leaves your mouth and hits your head. So I've done a lot of throwing up in the initial phase, and some people could take umbrage at me saying puking, and those same people, for crying out loud, they'll say vomit, and that just drives me up the wall, you know. I'm trying to be nice and refined up here, and I'm not going to go tell you that I vomited up my whiskey. I threw it up. But that was in the earlier phases when I was off at college. You know, I'm a young man in my 20s, and now a drink or two changed everything. And guess what? With a drink or two in me, I could go out amongst you and genuinely participate in the things you do. Genuinely participate. And this is something that sober I could not do, as I said earlier. Sober, I was a nerd. But with a drink or two or three in me, by God, I was charming. And if you don't think that's true, go home and ask your grandmother. And so I had absolutely, by accident, discovered the answer to a problem that I had lived with more or less all my life. And you see now why I was irritated when you picked on that thing, don't you? God love you. And I had accidentally discovered this solution, this total solution to my problem. And now I could learn, I had learned how to deal with people, and all I had to do was take a two or three drinks of alcohol, and I could go out and say, genuinely participate in the things that you did, and I liked that. And so I liked to drink when I was with people, and it wasn't just when I was with people that I liked to drink. I liked to drink sometimes when I was alone. My last name is O'Sullivan. And I like to have a drink or two or three and look at myself in the mirror and have long conversations with myself. And I used to call myself Sully Baby, and and you know, I'd slick my hair back and say, Sully Baby, you're going to make it. I never really had any idea of what I was going to make. I just knew that I was going to make it. And some of this mirror talking was done in the nude. Well, I can tell by the chuckles around the room that we've got a few nude mirror lookers in the room. And that's what I do. I mean, I get nude and have a drink or two or three and look at me in the mirror, and I'm not going to tell you what I said. And so I like to drink when I was just by myself, and a lot of times, like when I was going to dental school in New Orleans, and I lived in the second floor of an apartment building, and outside was what in the daytime was a kind of a cruddy looking scene, a couple of old streetcar tracks and a scraggly tree, but at night with a drink or two or three in me, by God, it was lovely. And I used to like to have a couple of drinks and sit there by that window and just look out at the sheer beauty of the night. And sometimes I'd be sitting by that window with a drink or two in me, and I'd get sweet music on the radio, and I'd cry. And I love to cry. I don't mean ball. I mean just fill up right to here with real hot tears and have them flow over my lid and course down my cheek. And I always did think that there was something beautiful about having a drink or two or three and feeling good and being sad. And I had purely by accident discovered a wondrous event in my life. And so I pursued the use of alcohol as a means with which to meet life. I used it as a resource with which to meet life. Now, if anybody is either now using or contemplating using alcohol as a resource with which to meet life, I think you should be advised of one thing, and that is this, that it contains a built-in hook. And the hook is that if you're using alcohol or anything else, as far as that's concerned, as a resource of which to meet life, you should know that you have to increase the dose with the passage of time, not to get ahead, just to keep even. And I go a step further. I don't care what it is that you're using as a resource of which to meet life. I think that we have to be willing to run the risk of increasing the dose with the passage of time, not to get ahead, but just to keep even. And I think that that's the reason that in the 11th step it says that we start through prayer and meditation to what? Improve our conscious contact with God. Because for me, at any rate, I stay sober by applying the 10th, 11th, and 12th step to my life on a daily basis. Now, I'm just putting that in there for free, because you may have a complicated program, but I don't. I apply the 10th, 11th, and 12th step to my life on a daily basis, and that's it. the tenth step for me is the willingness, at any rate, to wake up in the morning and at least entertain the possibility that my understanding of God yesterday may not be adequate to carry me through this day. So that my understanding of God, my conscious contact with God, has to be improved on a daily basis. That doesn't seem so dramatic when I look at it on a day-to-day basis, but when I look at it from today back down the lane, God knows my understanding of God has changed. And the answer, you know, the only alternative to that is to have a rigid God. That's what I came into AA with. I was telling John, one of the mistakes I made as a young person was I really wanted to be holy as a young person. Honestly, I did. I wanted to be holy. And I didn't understand that you have to become human before you can be holy. And so I had built up a God in my adolescence years. And I could, and what I did was, when I built him up, I made a monument of him in brick and plaster and stone, encircled with a circular concrete. And I could, when I came into AA and y'all started talking about God, I didn't have any problem with that. I could have taken you back down to Covington, Louisiana, and showed you where God was. I mean, he'd been down there for years and years, you know, imprisoned in that concrete. But there's another tremendous statement that's in the big book, and it's on page 58 also. Sometimes I say things about people that come in from treatment centers and they think that I'm running them down, and I'm not. The book says some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, but the result was nil until we let go completely. I don't want to seem like an intellectual, but nil means nothing. And all of us that come into AA, I believe, surely me, I had to throw away a lot of preconceptions, ideas that I had formed that just wouldn't hold water. But I had discovered this way of life. You see, what happened was, I knew I had a problem all my life, and then I discovered alcohol, and alcohol was the solution to the problem. And I set out on my merry way to be a success. And I achieved success. I finished dental school, I took an internship, I took some advanced courses in basic sciences. I was married, had a beautiful family, and just a gorgeous wife. And we were sent on a sensitive diplomatic mission to the Far East, actually to Formosa, and I had everything that they said an alcoholic wanted: money, power, prestige. I was, you know, staff dentist over there, on the general staff, a vehicle assigned to me only with a chauffeur, unlimited pass on the Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek's airline that flew from Australia to Formosa to Hawaii to Hong Kong and Tokyo. I mean, you couldn't have asked for anything more, but I had to increase the dose of alcohol that I was taking. And there's another thing, you see, you come up against body capacity. And depending on how big a person you are physically, that sets a limit to how much you can drink. I mean, you've got to increase the dose to keep level if you're going to use it as a resource of which to meet life. But at the other end of the spectrum, you're fighting a battle on kind of the size of your body, which will only absorb so much. And I never wanted to get drunk. Honestly, getting drunk to me was a slip in technique. Well, it's the truth. You know, I didn't really want to get drunk. Who wants to get drunk and go blabbering around out of control and all this stuff? One night I was waiting for my wife. I don't know why I was waiting for her. It was such an habitual thing, you know. It didn't make a big impression, and for want of anything else, I picked up a dictionary to look at. And idly, I looked up drunk, and it said intoxicated, and I looked up intoxicated. You know how dictionaries are. It said inebriated. I looked up inebriated, and there it said mildly excited. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, here again, totally without looking for it, I've discovered why I drank. I drank because I like to be mildly excited. And while that lasted, it was great, but there came a time when I couldn't predict how excited I would be. You know, I would be someplace on the underside of mildly excited, and I'd try to catch up, and I'd get too excited. And my wife's mother, and you notice I didn't say God bless her, I mean, she just didn't like me. Because when I was courting my wife, you know, we'd go to a movie or something like that, and I'd have a few drinks. And then I'd take her home, and in her home, and they were well-to-do people, they had space gas heaters. Well, I was already hot for a different reason. But I would go in and sit in the living room and get hot all over because of the space heater, and I'd throw up on the carpet. Well, you see, that doesn't endear you socially to any strata of society, much less a prospective mother-in-law. And you would think that of all the carpets I threw up on, I would have at least statistically thrown up on an old one. But I never did. It was always a brand new one. You know? So we were all in Formosa, and I was at the height of my success. I looked back on that dumb little country town, you know, and I thought to myself, boy, you have arrived. I didn't say that to anybody. Yes, I did, too. But, you know, mostly I would say this to myself at night, because night was my favorite time for what I call fantasy drinking. But anyway, people started talking ugly about me. They said I smell bad. Well, I admit, someplace in my drinking career, I stopped bathing. I didn't taper off, I just quit. But there was a reason for that. I had a traumatic experience, and, you know, my wife was a woman that I don't care what your problem was, her first suggestion was to take a good hot bath. Now, I'm a guy that believes that if you've been in there as long as I have, you do have to have a relative set of values that you're going to live by, and I do have a set of values that I live by, and I want you to know that I will take a bath. But I also want to be truthful with you and tell you that it's way down on my scale of values. I mean, I can think about, you know, 11 things that I'd rather do than take a bath, and about 15 that I'd rather do than take a good hot bath. But she was a good hot bath woman, and one night, I guess I was. Sometimes, you know, she'd do things to me when I was feeling all right. So I don't know whether I was feeling bad this night or what, but anyway, she coaxed me into taking a good hot bath, and it was on a Saturday night, and I had no sooner hit the water than it dawned on me that I didn't have enough booze to last me through the weekend. Now, at that time, we were living in San Antonio, and we lived uphill a block and a half from the Texas liquor stores, which closed at 10 o'clock on Saturday night and didn't open again until 6 o'clock Monday morning. I jumped out of that tub, and that woman had stole my britches. Now, I don't see anybody here, and I wouldn't expect to see anybody here because this is such a nice, decent group of people. But some places where I go, you see these tough, macho, leather jacket guys, you know. And if any of you should be here in disguise, I got a message for you. And the message is this: I don't care how tough you think you are, you ain't nothing without your britches. And I didn't pray much in those days. I didn't have anybody to pray to. But I found somebody to pray to real quick that night. I got on my knees, and I prayed to that woman to please give me back my britches. And she gave them back to me at the last possible second. And I put them and nothing else on. And raced downhill that block and a half to the Texas liquor store, walked in trying to look cool, and bought my weekend supply of booze. And I may have been sick, but I wasn't a fool. So I just quit bathing altogether. Now today, it wouldn't have been much of a problem because we got all this stuff. Now you can come in smelling like a goat and go, you know, and walk out and you're all right. And you can put secret under your arm, you know, and go up like this and all that. I told a story one time. This has got nothing to do with what I'm saying right now, but in a way it does. It's different how things are different back then and now. I was telling a story about one time I was going with a girl when I was in my teen years, and we had been riding in a car, and there was some woods out there, and she had on a one-piece bathing suit. I don't know what I had on, but it must have been elastic. And and we went out in the woods, and I got on top of her. And I got my fingers on the old shoulder strap of the bathing suit, and at that moment it became crystal clear that that's as far as I'm going to get. And so I leaned down on her throat in the last desperate attempt and kissed her, and it was the first time I had ever got a salty kiss. And I'll never forget that. Maybe there's some of you in the room who got a salty kiss, maybe not. As I said the night I first told it, today, you do that, you probably come up with a mouthful of safeguard. But back in those days, we didn't have all these high-powered deodorants. We had Mom. Some of you know what Mom is, little packet thing, you know, take it, boom, 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 out of there. Smells like it always did. I get a kick out of looking at some of this crap, you know. God gave us these chemicals that are called pheromones. And their sole purpose is to attract members of the opposite sex. And we've got multi-billion dollar industries that are talking you in to taking a shower with safeguard and then putting all this crap underneath there to mask the pheromones that God gave you to make the other sex come running after you. So I hope you have a good time. And then my hands were shaking. Well, I knew my hands were shaking, and I had dealt with that after. You know, and I'll admit, if you got a dentist coming at you with one of them long needles and his hand is steady, that's not too good. But if he's weaving in on you, you know, that's another story altogether. But I knew my hands were shaking. And I had taken steps to do something about it. My wife is a woman that always believed that you had to eat well. Her motto was, if you're going to be well, you have to eat well. And she wanted me to leave for work with a hearty breakfast under my belt. This is another thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. In those days, I couldn't sit down and eat. I had to get ready to eat. And it had to be an exact, precise, ready situation. If I got ready 30 seconds before mealtime, cancel the whole thing. I had to get ready at the same time you got the food done. Or otherwise the whole thing was all over. And I hear people talking about spirituality, you know, and sometimes I think that some of us have the idea that spirituality is the kind of a thing that would happen on inverted temperature day. When the fog began to condense outside and it would float in through the windows and settle over us and we would all get wringing wet with foggy spirituality. And coming back, John and I went to Mass, and coming back we stopped at Shoney's. And we just went in and sat down and ate. That's all there was to it. I had a steak, French fries, potatoes, and off the bar, I had some fish and some apricots, I guess. But you see, this was a highlight for me today. This is a tremendous spiritual experience for me. I didn't have to get ready to eat that stuff.
I just went in and sat down after I picked it all up and ate it. Didn't say to eat it. Didn't throw any of it up, by the way. So I don't have to look too far away for spiritual experiences. They're right here in front of me, day in and day out. God working in my life. If you had seen me, pitiful me, trying to eat, going off to work, and not being able to, that desperate thing, you know, one more drink and I can eat. Nah, damn it, eating's going to sober me up, and I got another drink. And that's a trick. I had to learn how to eat the breakfast to please her, and still get drunk enough to be able to eat and not get so drunk that I couldn't go to work. And that's work. I'm not talking about a 40-hour week. I'm talking about 365 days a year. I knew exactly how I was going to feel when I got up in the morning, sick as a dog. And just before I went to work, every time I start to talk about these things, I remember other people that have been more successful in their approaches. And then I want to tell about that, and I'd be here all night. I had a resentment against this guy. I mean, he's dead now, but I still got the resentment. This guy was the same ear, nose, and throat guy that thought he didn't get a part when the thing passed down the belt from God. And he got a part, all right. I mean, that I wish that had got it. As I said, he was the ear, nose, and throat guy, and he took his atomizer bottles and put a teaspoonful of fine whiskey in them and filled the rest up with water. And his office assistants had instructions that everybody that came into his office, they had to open their mouth and get sprayed with this stuff. And then, of course, they couldn't smell him. See, he was on the plane. But when I went to work, the last thing I would do before I left the house was I'd put a drop of Charlie Moore perfume on my tongue. And later on they had some proceedings against me in the Army, and they asked a major that had an office next door to me how I smelled when I came to work in the morning, and he said he smelled like a drunken French whore. And then they kept on griping about my hands shaking, and somebody told me, he said, well, look, if your hands are shaking, why don't you take a goofball or two? It's a grain and a half sodium second off. And if he said one or two, I probably took three or four. And it worked fine. I thought I had discovered a real solution. And then one day I went to sleep in a lady's lap. And boy, you talk about something. Her husband was a lieutenant colonel. I was just a captain. And you talk about something raising a stink. And I'm telling you, I mean, that whole place was in an uproar. And there's certain hazards in standing up here talking, too. That happened years ago. And I really don't expect any after effects from it today. But then I'm up in Peoria, Illinois, in the early part of this year, and talking, and I tell that story about going to sleep in the lady's back, and there's an old codger way in the back, and he jumps up and says, or asks, head up or down? Well, in all these years, I never had given that a lot of thought. But before I answered him, and I really didn't give him a satisfactory answer, I did remember sometimes that somebody had been talking about a spy mystery or something like that. And the problem was to tell whether a person dressed in certain clothes was a man or a woman. And they said that all you had to do was throw something toward their lap, and if it was a man, they'd close their legs up, and if it was a woman, they'd open them up. And, you know, I thought, hell, I ain't going to get into that damn thing now. And I went home from Peoria, and I'm in the house by myself since my wife died, and because I wouldn't want anybody to think I was engaging in erratic behavior. But I got on the bed, and I practiced that. You know, I would lean over like this like I was treating somebody, and then I'd try to go to sleep with my... You can't do it with your head up. So when I came back to the United States, Jesus Christ, that can't be right. When I came back to the United States, I knew something was wrong, so I went to an army doctor that was well thought of, and I told him I thought I might be an alcoholic. I don't know where I got that word from. He said, "I'm glad you came to see me." He said, "Just last week I cured a major general." I was a captain in the dental corps at the time, and I was delighted. You see, all I had to do, and look now, look at the situation as it really existed. Here is a man. All my life had been engaged in scientific endeavors, and then later, of course, in healing art. And here's a man whose life is dedicated to healing art. And I've gone in and I've stated my problem as best I know how to state it. And he says, "I'm glad you came to me last week. I just cured a major general." So they put me in the hospital. They stuck a lot of needles in me and out of me and helped me. And the cure didn't take. And for a long time, I thought it was because I was just a captain. And I'm not trying to be funny. I can remember walking down the street and saying to myself, you know, if I was just somebody else, all this wouldn't be happening. Sometimes people ask, where was the turning point, or what brought the turning point around? I could give a half a dozen answers to that, but I think the best answer is time. You know, just keep at it long enough and something's going to happen. You may die, I don't know. But if you don't, there's a good chance that something will happen. And that's what happened to me. The time came when I'd just gone far enough. We used to have a phrase for that in AA. I don't hear it much anymore. I just got sick and tired of being sick and tired. And it doesn't sound very profound, but that's very real. And evidently that had something to do, and I've heard two or three people over the weekend speak of this thing, maybe not in any specific terms, but in equivalent terms, that something in us has to click. I mean, I had to surrender. And I don't know how to tell you to surrender, except sometimes people say, surrender to what? And the answer to that is to surrender to the truth. You know, if you're drunk, you're drunk. You're not just a nervous person or something like that. Anyway, it was fast getting up on me, and I lost everything that I had. And this is, I hear so many alcoholics tell this same story. And we, in many ways, we alcoholics are pitiful people in that particular phase of our lives, because we do begin to lose the things. And again, I was thinking about this weekend's motto up here, and really, I'm not that familiar with it. But at least I think there comes a stage in life where we would be willing to love if we could, but we cannot accept love. And I think I see this in alcoholics generally, where we are great givers but poor receivers. And I still think that there's something within us that I call, well, I read once where a psychiatrist had said that all instincts could be reduced to two, the desire for procreation and the craving for affection. And I guess all human beings have this craving for affection. And we just can't let it in, that's all, at least I think. So I lost everything I had, money, house, home, car, children, family, everything. And I was reduced to the level of a street bum in the streets of the city of San Antonio, because there was nothing else left to do. I went back to this town, Lake Province, Louisiana, that I had left years before to become a success and a hero. And I hitchhiked into Lake Province one Labor Day weekend on a Tasty Bird poultry truck. And even that guy hurt my feelings, because I was telling him how he could make some money if he would follow some ideas that I had. When we came into town, and I remember he said, "I'm glad to know that's how you feel about it." Or something like that. And I went back there to my mother, who was in her 70s. And let me tell you another thing. You see, I'm just getting myself deeper and deeper in trouble, because these memories start popping into mind. But on October the 20th, I was the same age as my mother was when I came home. Her 41-year-old son, the pride of her life, came in the door dead drunk, no money, no wife, no family, no nothing. And the reason I figured that out was I set last October the 20th aside as a sort of a day of reconciliation, I guess you'd call it. All day long I tried to remember, to recognize how I felt And I've got grandchildren in that age group, and how I would feel if one of the more troublesome ones came and announced that he was going to live with me. And I wouldn't like it a bit. And I have to tell you people something. I mean, honesty requires that I say this. If you've gone out and wasted your life and you don't have any place to go, and you come home under the conditions that I came home, your parents will take you in, but I guarantee you, they will be not overjoyed to see you. And the first opportunity that they can see to get you on a minimum wage job and out of the house, they'll leap at it. And I was a guy that ran out of friends and enemies at the same time. A lot of people think if you don't have any enemies, you're in good shape, but that's not really so. The trouble is that many people don't understand that. They think that the opposite of love is hate, but it's not. The opposite of love is indifference. Love and hate have a lot in common. One thing that they have in common is that you're just as bound to the object of your feeling by one emotion as you are by the other. You're just as bound to somebody you hate as you are to somebody you love. That's how I sponsor people. I know I can't get them to love me, so I'll go ahead and get them to hate me. Anything to keep me on their mind. But I had run out of friends and enemies at the same time, and I went back to Lake Providence, this town I was born in that house with my mother in her 70s. And then my mother died. And then I was alone in that house all by myself. And the booze was getting harder to get. And you see, there's another side thought. I just detest these things for coming up. But I have a tremendous bond with Ernest and Julio. And they remind me continuously that it's time for me to begin to walk a low profile in Alcoholics Anonymous and let younger people come up and do the same that I'm doing tonight. Because I see where Ernest and Julio have developed a white Chardonnay. Whatever the hell that is, I'm proud. I am proud of Ernest and Julio. I came in with Ernest and Julio, only was with Muscatel. And I don't see them advertising Muscatel as a table delicacy on television today. And I feel hurt and lost and misplaced and just not with it. I long to see a Muscatel ad come out. And it ain't a bad wine, really. And if I ever got drunk again, if I decided to drink, I'd go back to Muscatel. It's rough on your underwear, I'll grant you that. But it does things that none of these other things will do. And then one time my time ran out and I surrendered. I surrendered to the truth. That I was a drunk, that's all. And I also could see what I was going to become. I was going to become a homeless drunk. And I don't think I minded being a drunk so much because I didn't know anything else. But I didn't want to be a drunk and homeless. And something snapped inside me. And I think I prayed, but I wouldn't bet on it. But whatever it was, something entered my life that night and changed it. I never have had a drink since then. And a guy came by and asked me if I'd go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said yes. I would have gone any place. That's all this guy said. He said, I'm glad he didn't say anything after, because this guy, he didn't have much of anything, really. I mean, I don't think he'd finished grammar school, and he would say Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and embarrass me. The guy didn't have anything going for him. He was sober, I mean, but I'm talking beside that. And so I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I ate it up from day one. I immediately started doing everything wrong, but at least I was doing something. And I had sponsors that were excellent sponsors, and I didn't have sponsors that I would call beautiful, or kind, or loving, or any of these other words. I had monsters for sponsors. And they were on me every time I turned around. I never did anything right. And I slept well, although I had anticipated not being able to sleep without the drinking, because I would stay awake half the night plotting how I could get even with the sponsors. And I saw hobgoblins in the steps, and they frightened me, and I said I wasn't going to do them all. And then I remember something that happened to me when I was a young kid, about 8 years old. I was an altar boy in a Catholic church, and one Sunday I had swiped a buck off the collection plate when I took it back in the sacristy to the priest, and he had noticed it, and he was waiting for me the next Sunday, and he caught me red-handed, and I got punished, and I couldn't accept the punishment. And I lived all over the world, and many a night in Cairo or France or wherever, I would be just about to doze off into a good night's sleep and up and pop that buck. And I'm not saying that it had anything to do with me being an alcoholic, but it did have something to do with me not having a lot of surrender. And I had sworn that nobody would ever know about that. The priest knew about it, my mother knew about it, I knew about it, that's all. And I came here to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I ran into some of you loose-mouthed people. Well, that's honest to God truth. I mean, there's some of you people who sit around and in casual conversation tell each other things that no sane human being would tell their attorney or their minister. And I decided that I was going to tell about stealing that buck, and I tried to do it, and I discovered another thing. It's almost impossible in AA to tell somebody what a rat you are. You start out to say, you know what a rat I am, they say, well, let me tell you what a rat I am. And I've often thought, you know, that if non-AA outsiders were looking in and they saw poor alcoholics, for example, at a table and there was a lot of talking going on, and they would think there was a whole lot of communication going on, but no, that's not what's happening. There's four monologues taking place. Everybody's just sitting around, you know, in neutral, waiting for somebody to take a deep breath so they can submarine in and take the conversation over. And I remember one night at home, I banged my fist on the table, and I said, by God, I'm going to keep going back to Alcoholics Anonymous until I tell somebody about stealing that buck if I have to go till I'm white-headed. So I was glad when I could find somebody who was surrounded, shut up. And let me tell them all these things I've been wanting to tell somebody really all my life. And I was really aware that I was taking a tremendous chance, because I knew it was a possibility that the guy that I chose, I might get halfway through, and he might say, look, we truly deal with the dregs of humanity, but we didn't have people like you in mind. But of course he didn't do that. He let me pile a whole bunch of crap on the desk. And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, you know, we love you. And for the first time in my life, I had experienced unconditional acceptance. There's a four-letter word for that. It's love. Love that has qualifications on it is not love. And so I kept coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lot has happened. But I'm running about 30 seconds ahead of time, so... I just tell you that the big thing that happened to me back is back on page 969. It's the last two lines at the bottom of the page, and it says, with few exceptions, our members have discovered that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource which they presently come to identify with their own concept of a power greater than themselves. Many of us believe that the awareness of that power is the essence of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Be tolerant with me while I say that one more time, and then I'm going to sit down. With few exceptions, our members discovered that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource which they presently come to identify with their own concept of a power greater than themselves. Many of us believe that the awareness of this power is the essence of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God conscious. Thank you very much.